This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A broad look at public education this hour. We'll also have a very personal story of how a fight for democracy online was both a victory and a horrible defeat for the late genius, internet genius, Aaron Swartz. It's an amazing new documentary, and it's a story you're not going to want to miss. Our look at police departments around the USA takes us to Seattle, Washington, where a new leadership and a new approach is changing some very bad habits there. But we begin in Iraq, where there is apparently a process for the embattled Iraqi government to reconstitute itself.
This is a multiple allied interest in having a unity government that can move Iraq to the future and pull it back from this precipice.
That's Secretary of State John Kerry at a news conference in Brussels on Wednesday talking about a national unity government. What would that consist of? According to the Iraqi constitution, parliament is required to convene within 15 days of the certification of election results of Iraq's highest court, making Monday, July 1st, the latest procedural day for something important to happen. Meanwhile, ISIS fighters advanced on the city of Haditha on the strategic Euphrates River. Joining me now from the ground in northern Iraq is Jane Araf, a journalist covering Iraq for the Al Jazeera America and the Christian Science Monitor networks. Welcome back, Jane.
Thanks, John.
So, Jane, just give me a sense of what is this procedural business that could possibly have any impact on what's going on with ISIS right now?
Well, I'm here in Baghdad, and as you can imagine, the capital is kind of swirling with all this talk about who's going to form the government. Is Prime Minister Maliki going to be able to cobble together this coalition? But I think the key question we have to ask ourselves is, how much is this really going to matter? Now, as you mentioned, there is a constitutional deadline for Parliament to meet, and they will do so. But the really tough thing is, he is battling to remain Prime Minister in a country that's substantially different than it was less than 3 weeks ago when the second biggest city fell to ISIL, the fighters. So basically, he's working hard to bring in the Sunnis, to bring in the Kurds, to get enough support that he can remain prime minister. And that will at least, if it works, reduce some of the political paralysis that's been part of the reason why this country is so dysfunctional in security terms.
Would Shiites have to declare themselves in solidarity with Sunnis, Kurds in this parliamentary vote, and would it in any way outweigh or outvote what seem to be the facts on the ground in places like Fallujah?
Well, one of the big problems here is that the Sunnis particularly are very divided. There isn't one Sunni faction, so there isn't a solid bargaining bloc or political faction that can be negotiated with. The Kurds are the most cohesive, of course, because they've been fighting a common front for years now. But essentially what's going to happen in Parliament is it's going to be largely ceremonial. They will meet. They will say they've met that constitutional deadline. But we won't have a government then. It's just Parliament meeting. Now, last time around, when Maliki tried to put together a coalition government under much more favorable circumstances, it took 9 months. Now, he doesn't have 9 months now. He barely has a few weeks. But nobody's expecting that when Parliament meets next week, there will be a new government. That process is expected to take a little bit longer.
What do people say on the streets of Baghdad about the possibility of Parliament and the court system and the government that's in place creating some sort of national unity government that would push Nouri al-Maliki aside on some level?
It's a really interesting dynamic here because despite the fact that a lot of people actually did go out and vote in the last elections almost 3 months ago now, there isn't really an expectation that politicians can do very much. I was in Qadamiya this week, which is the main, there's a Shia shrine there that is one of the holiest sites in Shia Islam. And it's part of the reason that in this conflict with the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, Baghdad is the prize. It has a huge Shia shrine. It's the capital city. It was in history the center of a huge Islamic empire. So people there were saying they don't think that a new prime minister can help. They don't think the old prime minister can help. Really, what this has come down to is the scary prospect of militias again coming into the streets, and that's what's happening. Shia religious leaders have told their people that their obligation is, if they can, to join the Iraqi security forces and fight. And at that shrine and in other places in Baghdad, that's exactly what people are prepared to do. They're not waiting for their political leaders.
Let's talk before we go about this city of Haditha that's right in the center of the Euphrates River. Is there any sense that ISIS would take control of one of those dams and would do something to actually radically damage or disrupt the agricultural sector of Iraq, even cause flooding in the cities?
Now, this is a really interesting thing about ISIS, because it's not the al-Qaeda that we knew. The ISIS that went into Mosul and so effectively took it, helped, of course, by the retreat of the Iraqi security forces, has teamed up with former Baathists, it's teamed up with tribal leaders, and it is launching a relatively sophisticated attempt to run that city in its fashion. But it's doing things like handing out salaries, making sure the streets are clean. It wouldn't be expected to blow up the Haditha Dam. That's not in its interest. As one Iraqi government official said to me, in any war, there are areas of common interest. Now, he was explaining why when they held the Beji oil refinery, they were prepared to run it. I'm talking about the gunmen. Because it's not in their interest to be cutting off electricity or drowning the residents in nearby towns. They want this to be their new Islamic State. They want to be the rulers, but they want to be what they see as effective rulers, and they still do need not to completely terrify the population. And there's a realization there that they're using calibrated terror. They're telling people that they are after the security forces, the government, but the people themselves will be safe.
They want a functioning Iraq. They don't want a slaughterhouse, that's for sure. Jane Iraf, journalist covering Iraq for Al Jazeera America, talking about what is the apparent mission of ISIS at this point. Jane Iraf was speaking to us from Baghdad. Jane, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
Speaking of common interests, the interests of Iran and the United States may be in line in the situation in Iraq. Joining me now is Iranian-American journalist Hooman Majid, the author of The Ministry of Guidance Invites You Not to Stay, an American Family in Iran. Welcome to the program, Hooman.
Thank you, John.
So do you think Iran is actively taking steps to encourage Shiites to either coalesce into their own sort of Shiite protectorate, or to, in some ways, throw in with this procedural symbolism of the parliamentary procedure that Jane Iraf was just talking about?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I think the Iranians have been pretty clear to try to not frame what's going on in Iraq as a sectarian issue. And they've actually tried to do the same thing in Syria all these years while they've supported Assad and the Assad regime. I think it's the same thing here, and I think that's also what actually, oddly enough, the United States is trying to do, which is to not frame it in sectarian issues, not to try to take sides, particularly with one sect over the other, and be cautious in the way they support the Iraqi government, which is exactly what the U.S. is doing. It's very important for the Iranians for it not to become a sectarian issue, because Iran does need the so-called Arab street to be sympathetic to Iran and not be hostile to it, as it has been in recent years because of Syria mainly, and partly because of Iraq. But yes, I mean, in terms of protecting the Shia holy sites, there is no question that Iran and the Shia militias that they have had influence over in the last 10 years will never allow that to happen. Will never allow those Shia holy sites to fall to ISIS or to any other group that is as proclaimed that they will destroy them. So that won't happen. Baghdad won't be allowed to fall either. And I don't think the U.S. wants Baghdad to fall either. So there are allied interests. I mean, in terms of a more inclusive government, a less sectarian government, I think Iran is absolutely fine with that. I mean, we do have to remember that when Iran fought an eight-year war with Iraq, the vast majority of the soldiers fighting Iran were Shia. So there is no illusion among Iranians or among Iraqis that the Shias of Iraq and the Shias of Iran are, just because they're from the same sect, bosom buddies. There are common interests. And Iran is acting in its national interests, which is to not have a country on its border in turmoil and potentially with a group like ISIS in control of parts of the territory that would threaten Iran as well.
So certainly common interests, but ethnic differences in the sense that Iraqi Shia are Arab and Iranian Shia are Persian by ethnicity. We're talking with Hooman Maj, who's the author of The Ministry of Guidance Invites You Not to Stay, an American Family in Iran. Could Iran credibly, and there's plenty of precedent for this going back 1,000 years, could Iran credibly be a neutral military protector of the Shiite holy sites as Jordan was during the many, many years that Muslims controlled multi-religious access to Jerusalem?
I think that would only happen if Iraq did, in fact, splinter, which I think is unlikely at this stage, but is a possibility. It's a possibility that those lines that were drawn by the British at the early part of the 20th century will disappear. If that were to happen, yes, I think Iran would take on that role. But I don't think Iran wants to be seen in that role, at least certainly not yet, because I think, again, it points to a sectarian and an ethnic issue that the Iranians don't really want to get involved with.
On some level, Hooman, has this initiative by the Iranians, is it a suggestion that Nouri al-Maliki overreached here in his almost mafia-like, patronage of Shia interests in Iraq?
Yeah, I don't think it's so much Shia interests. I mean, we have to remember that Iraq is 60% Shia, 20% Kurd, who are Sunnis, but are kind of a separate ethnic group that have very little to do with the rest of Iraq, and only 20% Sunni. It's less about Shia interests than it is a purely kind of like vengeful sectarian position that Maliki has taken. I think that Iran is not comfortable with that, and I think they've made it clear to Maliki, although he is still an ally of Iran. And I do think that they will work to try to change that as much influence as they can bring to bear to try to change that scenario, because, as I said, it is not in Iran's interest. Iran has a Sunni population of its own. It has a Kurdish population of its own. And it has Arabs in the south of Iran, ethnic Arabs in Iran. There is no interest for Iran to kind of like encourage a sectarian issue here. I think, Iraq is strange. I mean, this is a country where the iron fist of Saddam Hussein came down most hard on Shias, as we know from history. And many of the Shias in government today in Iraq spent their exile years in Iran. And some of the Kurds spent their exile years in Iran. Talibani spent his time in Iran, for example, the president of Iraq. And so did Maliki. So they have a particular hatred for Iraq, or when I say Iraq, for Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and for the Sunnis and the Ba'athists, particularly, that ruled Iraq and killed and tortured many of their co-religionists. So I think Iran would like to see a stable Iraq to the extent that it can be stable. But I certainly would agree that they will never allow the Shia holy sites to be overrun by Sunnis.
Well, I didn't even get to ask you the Disneyland question, which is, could the U.S. and Iran work even more closely together in this crisis, which would really be something to imagine, but we can all dream about that. Hooman Maj is Iranian-American journalist and author of The Ministry of Guidance Invites You to Not Stay, an American Family in Iran. Hooman, thanks. Police are the face of the government for most people, the tangible face of both law and order. It's a relationship where small events can have big consequences.
Hi, this is Ben calling from Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm a former police officer in Wisconsin, and since moving to Minnesota in the past 8 or 10 years, I have witnessed what I would consider appalling violations of human rights by the Minneapolis and surrounding suburb police departments.
You've been telling us stories about your own police department, thanks there to Ben in Minneapolis, but today we look at problems in Seattle. The Attorney General, Eric Holder, and the Department of Justice have begun a number of federal investigations into local police departments for complaints from civilians and defendants. The city of Seattle has its own experience with DOJ that ended with a consent decree where federal authorities would have oversight over the Seattle Police Force's excessive use of force. It stemmed from this incident in 2010 when Officer Ian Burke shot and killed John T. Williams, a Native American woodcarver, holding just a small knife.
Hey! 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 Put the knife down!
This incident prompted a DOJ investigation and compounded problems in Seattle that stemmed from the infamous World Trade Organization protests of 1999, where aggressive crowd control tactics by the Seattle Police Department using chemical agents were some of the most violent riots in city history. Amy Radel is a reporter for member station KUOW who remembers the bad old days in Seattle.
And that's when you really saw the marches on City Hall and people being really upset about use of force in policing. So the Department of Justice came in. They did an investigation, which SPD cooperated with, gave them some records. Their findings were that there's an excessive use of force by Seattle police, and they estimated in 20% of their encounters when force is used. That was kind of the headline of the investigation. And so then 2012 was basically spent figuring out a consent decree between the city and the DOJ with kind of the threat of a federal lawsuit hanging over the city if they didn't work something out.
Do people in the community have a sense that First Nation groups, Native Americans, Indians have a tense relationship with law enforcement in the Seattle community?
This incident, yes, I think they would say yes. And I think African Americans would also come forward and say that they have a tense relationship with the police in Seattle.
And does this vary from neighborhood to neighborhood, or is this something that is widespread across the entire community? Because there are very many neighborhoods in Seattle and very different socioeconomic levels in those neighborhoods.
Right. And I think, yeah, it does vary by neighborhood. And right now, one call that I just saw from an activist in South Seattle, she said that they're worried about what they call depolicing, that police now, they're under so much scrutiny that they're actually backing off. They're not pursuing suspects. They're not pursuing investigations. And so she's saying in South Seattle, she wants to see more, you know, crimes being solved by police. And one of the other DOJ finding, which didn't rise to the same level as the excessive use of force, but they also said they found troubling evidence of biased policing. And so police now are going to have to keep incredible records of everyone they stop and have contact with in order for the department to drill down and try to see if there are patterns in terms of the people that police stop and investigate.
And part of that is the stipulation of the lawsuit that was filed and has finally been adjudicated, yes?
Under the consent decree, yes. Even though the DOJ didn't really have as substantive of a finding in that area, everyone kind of agreed that there are perceptions that it's a problem, and the police as well have said that they want to work on that.
Do people believe this is the end of the matter? Is the law enforcement community taking this consent decree with a sense of, all right, we're going to improve?
It's been so interesting. I mean, people were, the police chief, John Diaz, I remember the day that the DOJ findings were announced, and he was kind of defiant and said, this department is not broken. And they have always said that the DOJ never gave them the records behind their findings. So there are a lot of people who don't accept what the DOJ said were its findings. But then a lot of people eventually have kind of said, well, we still do need to improve. Let's move on. And as you may know, there was a lawsuit filed by a group of Seattle police officers at the end of May that really gives us a window into the officers who are very upset about the direction this process has taken. They say that they're being encumbered with all these heavy-handed new policies that make it very hard for them to do their jobs, that put them at risk. And these officers are really out on their own. They're not even, the union isn't involved. The leadership of SPD isn't involved. It's just over 100 officers. They don't even have a lawyer representing themselves in a federal civil rights lawsuit trying to challenge this process with the DOJ.
So this is part of what's keeping the debate going. How about new leadership at the SPD?
Yeah, we're in a really interesting moment because this week we've just confirmed a new police chief in Seattle. Her name's Kathleen O'Toole. She's the first woman to ever lead the department. She's the former Boston police commissioner. And right now, everyone on every side is very excited and hopeful about her record and what she's bringing to the department. So I think there's a sense of hope about the stability of some new leadership because they've been without a permanent chief for a while all these things have been kind of swirling.
A lot of the public perception of law enforcement and of its effectiveness relates to crime statistics in the Seattle area. And some of that can be inflamed by the media and some of that can be objective numbers. What's the sense in Seattle of crime statistics going up or down?
The police just released some very preliminary statistics indicating that officers are making fewer arrests and, tackling crime less aggressively on the street. No one's really sure what to make of that data. They're going to take a while to analyze it, but it kind of fed into this debate of are officers stepping back because of all the scrutiny.
So the police have an interest in suggesting that the scrutiny has possibly had a chilling effect on police being aggressive on the streets.
Exactly. And one officer said in the media unit said that actually officers are having to spend so much more time per case that they're involved in because of all the new record keeping and documentation that maybe that will turn out to be one explanation for these statistics.
Amy Radel is a reporter for member station KUOW in Seattle. Thanks so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
A coalition of mayors and brain scientists are trying to get the U.S. government to make early childhood education both a priority and a right in America. This latest initiative, rolled out at the U.S. Conference of Mayors this week in Dallas, would be the first attempt to incorporate the latest brain science into actual preschool programs while addressing parent needs for daycare and public school needs for kids to be prepared to start kindergarten at grade level. It's called Early Childhood Nation. And it's funded by the Bezos Family Foundation that is already funding actual programs for schools and homes called Vroom. Education Secretary Arne Duncan supports the program that got a unanimous vote of approval from the U.S. Conference of Mayors this week. He sat down exclusively to talk about early childhood education with The Takeaway while we were in Dallas over the weekend.
First of all, this is the best investment we as a nation can make in our children, in our families and strengthening families, and in terms of having a strong, viable economy long term. So I'm just an absolutely huge proponent. The impediments are, by definition, to significantly expand access as we need to do. You have to invest. You have to spend some money. Mayors get this in a bipartisan way. Governors get this in a bipartisan manner. 30 governors are investing, actually more Republicans than Democrats. We think that's fantastic. That common sense, that leadership that's happening in real cities and real states hasn't translated yet to Washington.
You know, in many ways, one of the legacies of the Obama administration, aside from some notable examples, is working around the legislative process, convening other levels of government to try to solve problems. Is that a sustainable future for the federal government when we really think about here in the city of Dallas the sort of LBJ missions that involved a federal, state, local, congressional partnership with the White House?
Well, I think we have to work on every front. And I always say education should be the ultimate bipartisan issue. And we work in an absolutely non-political, non-ideological way. We're thrilled high school graduation rates are at all-time high. This is in everyone's best interest. So we will continue to convene. We will continue to bring people together. And we'll continue to work very, very hard to build more bipartisan support for this.
So then what are the investments that need to be made? We've got wars ending, supposedly, in Iraq and Afghanistan, even though frustrating crises facing the president right now overseas in Europe and in the Middle East. Where are the resources going to come from? And what are you waiting for to happen?
So we've invested our department in partnership with HHS, which has been a fantastic partner, over $1 billion to date. We feel fantastic about that. Historically, our department did very little in the early childhood space, and we're seeing many, many states step up to increase both quality and access. Just in the next couple months, we're going to put out another $250 million, so we're continuing to invest. We're just not investing at the scale that I think our nation needs and our children deserve. And so for us to go to that level, the president has proposed a $75 billion program, not any kind of mandate or anything like that, but where we would simply partner with states and local communities that are investing themselves and leverage all of our scarce resources and take tens of thousands of children off of waiting lists. To do that, you need a new revenue source. We've proposed a tobacco tax and open to other ideas, but you can't do this at a zero revenue point. We have to increase our investment in high-quality early learning opportunities from birth through age 5.
Does that involve a federal commitment that really changes the relationship between the federal government and local and state traditional responsibilities for schools? Do we need to say in the United States that education is a federal responsibility for the first time?
Well, again, just on the early childhood space, all we want to do is simply partner. and where you have mayors who are investing and governors who are investing and increasing, you know, the number of seats and quality significantly. Again, what's heartbreaking to me is to see so many states that are doing the right thing in communities where you still have waiting lists of 8,000, 10,000, 12,000, 15,000 kids. And so we simply want to go in where local communities are investing. Let's match them. Let's leverage. Let's figure out how to work that together. And so it's, again, no mandate or anything like that, but simply a partnership so that we are all working together on behalf of children and creating stronger communities.
Arnie Duncan has been Education Secretary under the Obama administration since 2009. He previously served as the head of the Chicago school system.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Aaron Schwartz astounded his parents, who, with three already very gifted little boys, discovered that one of them, Aaron, could read at age three. By age 14, he was already advising high-level software designers on advanced scientific protocols for what would eventually become the internet architecture for all of social media. Designers would ask little Aaron why he never showed up at their meetings, and he had to tell them that his mom would never let him fly by himself at age 14. He was an early partner and creator of Reddit, a millionaire at the age of 19, who gave it all up for a higher value, making the emerging internet a force for freedom, democracy, and for good.
Growing up, you know, I slowly had this process of realizing that all the things around me that people had told me were just the natural way things were, the way things always would be, they weren't natural at all. They were things that could be changed, and they were things that, more importantly, were wrong and should change. And once I realized that, there was really kind of no going back.
Aaron Schwartz speaking there back in 2010, just months before he was arrested for using the digital repository JSTOR to download a trove of academic articles through MIT's computer network. Schwartz would be indicted by a federal grand jury, eventually charged by federal prosecutors on more than a dozen total charges, facing a prison sentence up to 50 years plus $1 million in fines. He was offered a plea deal to essentially agree that he was a criminal, a felon, something he could never do.
He just didn't believe that he could continue in his life with a felony. You know, he said to me one day, we were walking by the White House, and he said to me, they don't let felons work there.
That's Schwartz's former girlfriend, Quinn Norton, speaking in the new documentary, The Internet's Own Boy, the story of Aaron Schwartz, and how for Schwartz, true freedom could only mean killing himself. A monumental loss for the internet community and the people fighting for open access to the online world. Brian Knappenberger is the director of that film.
Right after he passed, there was this big wave of anger and frustration and sympathy that came even from people that didn't know him. And I think that the reason for that is that he did sort of symbolize a kind of choice, I think. A lot of people responded to, it seemed to me, a choice that he made after they sold Reddit to Condé Nast. That sale made him a really rich 19-year-old. And instead of staying on that kind of Silicon Valley startup treadmill, in other words, doing what most people do, which is just do it again, build the flip, you know, find another, you know, another business, sell it to a big corporation again, he took a pretty decisive turn towards social justice issues, towards political organizing, towards using his skills, putting them in the public interest. And I think ultimately that's probably what people respond to the most about his story.
How do you think he stumbled on this, you know, when you look at it, it's completely bizarre, but this situation where publicly supported research, academic research, is actually only available through companies that get it for free, but because it's academic can charge you outrageous fees for it. There are all kinds of companies that do this. One quoted in your film made $3 billion in 1 year doing it.
Yeah,
he said, "Wait a minute, this isn't public. If it costs this much money, I'm going to hack a way around it, and nobody's going to stop me."
It's an odd system. There's no question. It's an odd system that locks a lot of people out. Locks a lot of knowledge up in the kind of ivory tower. And people are offended by this. And Aaron was a part of a group of people that think that this is wrong. But I'd made a previous film called We Are Legion, The Story of the Hacktivists, which profiled a lot of people that are angry, frustrated with the system. In fact, they just want to burn it down and start over. Aaron was not one of those people. Aaron, to me, seemed like he wanted to work very much within the system. He wanted to sort of hack, quote-unquote, hack it in the best possible sense, understanding that social systems can be changed and altered. But I think he wanted to do that within the system. And I think a felony really takes you out of that system. I mean, you can't even vote in some states if you're a felon. And that was the one thing the prosecutors were never going to budge on. They wanted him to be a felon. They wanted him this to include a felony.
And so without that felony, he maintained his power to go up against some of the most formidable forces in Congress on two bills on changing the internet, one called SOPA, the other called PIPA.
Mm-hmm.
Bills that would, during the 90s, during the Clinton 90s, when no one was paying attention, would probably have just like floated through.
Without Aaron and his and a few others paying attention, this one probably would have too.
Sir, absolutely. He's the gatekeeper. He's the watchman on the beat. And he stands between this is going to pass, no-brainer.
Yeah.
And absolutely turns everything around. Tell that story.
Yeah, he does. Well, it's him and he gets a ball rolling and a couple of groups really get on board. But he has this ability to kind of explain these complex issues to people in ways that they find relevant to their lives. And he was able to kind of take the message of SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, and really explain it in ways that got people motivated, that made them understood that this was going to be damaging to this thing that they love, this kind of openness of the internet.
And Stop Online Piracy, everybody says, oh, that's a good idea.
Well, it's misleading.
Aaron was able to say, no, what it really means is if anybody suspects anybody else of piracy, all they have to do is, you know, make a single phone call and they could shut down any small website on virtually no evidence. It's a reversal of the burden of proof.
Right. That's well put. So he's upset about this. This looks like it's a foregone conclusion, by the way. Like it's already passed all the procedural hoops. It's ready. And there is an online protest that really gains a lot of steam. Lots of other groups got on board, and finally that culminated in a blackout day where a lot of people actually blacked out their websites and ultimately –
We're not just talking about like, you know, Travelocity. We're talking about like Wikipedia.
Wikipedia, number 4 most visited website on the net.
Reddit.
Yeah. Google even. Everybody got on board. And you just saw the people, Congress folks, fleeing from this. I mean just jumping ship. And it was dead within a period of about 48 hours. I mean, look, this is how democracy should work in the digital age. It was kind of a shining example of a potential. I mean, this is how you do it. You're upset. You know, lots of people agree with you, and you petition your members of Congress, and they do what they're supposed to do. It's just that never happens. So it's one of the things that made it so extraordinary.
You use your brain. You make an argument. You use the mechanisms of a free society to argue your case, and the truth shall out.
It's what we learn as kids, right?
But why doesn't this story have a happy ending?
Well, even in the middle of that very kind of huge victory, really, the SOPA victory, he's still dealing with this incredible, awful prosecution. And once the prosecution starts, it's just this machine that can't be turned around again. The prosecutor keeps ramping up charges against him. He's initially charged with 4 felony counts in his initial indictment. Then later he's given a superseding indictment that ups that to 13. 11 of the 13 are the result of this wildly outdated law called the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And he gets to a point where there aren't going to be any more plea deals. Trial is looming. And he ends up taking his own life, actually within a few days of the 2-year anniversary of his initial arrest.
What effect did that have on the people around him? People who were amazed by his brilliance, who were amazed by his bravery, who were terrified of his willingness to put himself in harm's way.
I mean, I think devastating is probably understating it, you know. I mean, they're mortified by this loss. One of the things that's really striking about his story is how many people that didn't know him were also moved by his story. That's part of the impetus for creating the documentary.
Brian, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Brian Knappenberger is the director of The Internet's Own Boy, the story of Aaron Schwartz. It opens in theaters this Friday. Remembering Aaron Schwartz, thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.